Welcome once again to the Mike Wilson Show on WWGH. And I'm really excited today. Whoop, I'm pounding on the desk. I'm that excited. My guest today is going to be former president, U.S. Mr. Grant.
That's what Mrs. Grant refers to me
as. Yes, yeah, sir. We can't. We're not allowed to smoke cigars in here.
Oh.
But as I was saying,
our guest. Gunpowder stored somewhere?
No, sir. It's a different world than the world that you were in.
Well,
so we have
Mrs. Grant says I shouldn't smoke so much anyway. So it may be to the good.
We have former president, former general, U.S. Grant with us today, and we're going to talk about his life.
Former leather clerk.
you tried several jobs over the years, didn't you? Before.
Well, I worked at a number of things. I was not successful at most of them. I farmed. I even owned a slave for 2 years.
Oh, my.
Well, it was given to me by my father-in-law as compensation for helping manage his farm. He had slaves, but he didn't have much money. Two years later, I got out of farming and released the slave, a fellow named William Jones. Told him to get across the river from Missouri to Illinois. But, no, I've...
Well, I'd kind of like to talk about your life,
where do you want to
start?
Even
your early life here in Ohio. And was it Point Pleasant where you were born?
I was born down at Point Pleasant, but I don't have much recollection. We moved away when I was 11 months old.
And so, to where did you move?
Georgetown, the county seat of Brown County.
Okay.
I grew up there, lived there till I went off to the military academy in 1839.
All right. So you don't have much recollection of your very, very early days in the place where you were born.
No. No, I don't. Many more recollections of growing up in Georgetown.
Well, let's talk about Georgetown. What happened there? Some of the things you remember about your time in Georgetown, Ohio.
Well, my father, Jesse, was a very successful tanner and leather merchant. Unfortunately, we lived right next to the tan yard. And if you've ever been out in August in Ohio heat and humidity with raw cow hides.
Oh, my.
I think you can guess that it wasn't the best neighborhood to live in. Matter of fact, living around those and to some extent having to work with them permanently cured me of the idea of eating rare meat. If there's a speck of blood on the plate, I can't face it.
That kind of stuck with you over the years,
it
apparently.
It did indeed.
What can you tell us? Well, can you go back even a little further? Can you tell us about your mother and father and how they met?
Well, my father, Jesse, met my mother. When he turned 26, he decided he had enough money to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked around, and my mother turned out to be a hardworking, quiet person who would put up with my father, who was... A person of strong opinions and loud voice. So they, in that way, they made a nice match.
So that's where you get that from?
A little bit, I guess. When I was in the White House, I invited my mother to come visit me in Washington. Both my father and father-in-law had done so. And she said, well, I'd like to visit the White House, but I'd rather do it when a Democrat was living there. Since I was of the wrong party, she never did come visit me in Washington.
Oh, my. Okay, so Brownstown?
No, Georgetown.
Georgetown, okay.
Yeah, county seat of Brown County.
Okay, if I don't write things down, sir, I don't always remember them.
I have the same problem as time goes along.
Okay, and in Georgetown, of course, as you said, your father was a tanner. I presume you were a straight-A student in school.
I was a mediocre student at best.
One of those different...
I didn't particularly enjoy going to school. What I liked was being around horses.
Okay.
And as soon as I got old enough to manage a team, which was around age 8, I convinced my father to let me stop scraping hides and do whatever we could do needed to be done with horses, whether it was hauling logs for the bark for the tanning pit or plowing and harvesting the the few acres that Dad owned, Papa owned outside of town. Matter of fact, by the time I was 12 or so, I was running kind of a livery service. People would come to my father and say, I need to go to Cincinnati or Columbus or on one occasion, Wooster, if I remember right. He'd have me get out the buggy, hitch up a horse, and away I'd go. Oh. I'd be gone sometimes for several days at a stretch.
And at what age was this again?
About 12.
About 12? Wow, what an entrepreneur.
Well, it was more my father's idea that I was going to go out and do it, but he was the businessman in the family.
Mm-hmm. Were you successful with that? Sounds like you were.
He made some money at it, yes. Mm-hmm. And within reason, if there was money in the family, he was willing to let us have things we wanted. I once had to beg him for the opportunity to buy a colt, but it worked out more or less, although not as he had hoped.
Mm-hmm. Well, after your business venture there with the horses, where did you go from there?
Well, as I say, I loved horses, but I wasn't a very canny trader in horses. So when I was about 15, my father said, Ulysses, I've decided you don't have a career in business. You don't have a head for it, so I'm going to send you to college. Well, that sounded all right to me. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm going to send you to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And I said, well, Papa, I don't believe I want to be a soldier. And he said, well, I believe you're going to go.
Oh, my.
It turns out his faith was stronger than mine, so I, in the spring of 1839, I did go. Unfortunately, well, I don't know whether it was fortunate or not. I got a new name by going off to the Army.
Yeah, tell us. That's an interesting story. Let's hear about that.
My father and mother had named me Hiram Ulysses Grant. My father named me Hiram because his father-in-law thought it was a good name for a boy. Ulysses became my middle name because my father's mother-in-law had been reading a book about Odysseus, and so Papa was trying to play up to both of his in-laws, and that's how I got Hiram Ulysses. Now, as a child, most everyone called me Ulysses or Ulysses, or if things weren't going well with me and the other boys, sometimes Useless. But when Papa decided that he was going to try to get me into West Point, he wrote his congressman and asked him if he would nominate me. The congressman remembered that most of the time he had heard me addressed or referred to as Ulysses, so he wrote that on the application, and he was pretty sure I had a middle name. So he put down S because Mama had been a Simpson, and he guessed maybe that would be my middle name. When I got to West Point and tried to enroll at the academy, the mustering officer asked me for my name and state of residence. I told him, Hiram Ulysses Grant, Ohio. Now, he looked down this long ledger page he had for us to sign in on and said, I'm sorry, young man. There is no Hiram Ulysses Grant from anywhere on this list. There is a Grant, Ulysses S., from Ohio. If that's you, sign in. If it isn't, move along. I have work to do. So I signed in as Ulysses S. because that's what Congressman Hamer had told him, and I spent 4 years at West Point trying to convince the Army that that was not my name. I failed. Now at the Academy, the West Point at that time, I don't know if you know this, was very big on giving people nicknames. William T. Sherman, of whom more later, was known as Cump for Tecumseh. That was his middle name.
Okay.
James Longstreet somehow became Pete Longstreet. And I became Sam Grant because on the muster roll, when they'd list us for duty, I was Grant, U.S., and somebody said, oh, that must stand for United States. And Sherman, as it happened, said, no, U.S., that's Uncle Sam. And I guess being called Sam is better than being called United States by your colleagues. I can tell anyone who used to know me in the old Army because they address me as Sam, as do my close friends even now. So that's how I got into the Academy. I managed to get out at the end of 4 years. I graduated 21st in a class of 39, which indicates that I was not a straight-A student there either.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But I graduated. The only things I showed any proficiency in were mathematics and horsemanship. I had hoped after a couple of years to return to the Academy as a mathematics instructor, but events overtook me, so that didn't happen.
Events such as the Civil War, I'm presuming?
Well, no, there was a war before that.
Oh, and yes.
I was assigned to the 4th Infantry Regiment at Jefferson Barracks outside of St. Louis in 1843 when I graduated. In 1844, they decided to move us down the Mississippi to the Pine Bluffs country down in Arkansas and Louisiana. At that time in history, the United States was talking very strongly about annexing Texas, and that put us near the Texas border in case we were needed. Mm-hmm. We stayed out in the woods for about a year and finally got rotated down to New Orleans to a formal military post with regular barracks and everything again. That lasted a few months, and then off to Texas and eventually on to Mexico. So we didn't stay very long in one place.
Okay. Well, we'll talk more about your military experience here in a little bit, but I'm interested in hearing by this time you're probably married to Julia, aren't you?
No.
Not yet.
I was engaged to Julia.
Okay.
Her father didn't think that Army officers made good marriage material, which was odd because his son, Fred, had been my roommate at West Point and was also an Army officer. In any event, before we set off for Arkansas and New Orleans and Mexico on the war, I did get Colonel Dent, that was Julia's father, and he was no more a colonel than the man in the moon, but he was sort of a Kentucky colonel.
Oh, okay. Did he sell chicken?
I don't know.
Okay. Just asking.
He ran a 900-acre farm, so I imagine if he could find a buyer, he'd sell them. But he said, well, when you come back from the war, he didn't say if, but he says, when you come back, I'll consider the idea of you marrying Julia. Well, I left in 1844 and didn't get back till 1848, but Julia waited for me, and soon after I returned, we did get married. So that's when Julia came into the picture. Her brother Fred had been my roommate 1 year at West Point, and in the years since, I have come to the conclusion that Julia makes a much better roommate than Fred ever did.
Oh, I'm sure she does, sir. Okay. Where was the wedding performed, if I may ask?
Well, it was performed at her father's farm or plantation, as he liked to style it, White Haven, outside St. Louis.
Okay. excuse me. We seem to both have the same malady here.
I guess we do.
So Julia and you lived happily ever after then.
Well, I was always glad to be married to Julia. When I came back from the war in Mexico, we were assigned first to the Madison Barracks at Sackett's Harbor, New York, for a year, then to regimental headquarters at Detroit, Michigan, for a year, then back to Sackett's Harbor for a year, and then in 1852, when Julia was about 8 months pregnant, the Army decided that the 4th Infantry and I were going to go off to the West Coast to Oregon Territory. So I'm
presuming at that time you would not have taken her with you.
She wanted very much to go. I absolutely refused to take her, which was good. We lost 3/4 of the wives and children who went along with us, and about 1/4 of the troops to cholera when we were crossing the Isthmus of Panama between the Atlantic and the Pacific. So it's just as well she didn't go along, and more than just as well, because I could not have begun to feed a wife and 2 children on the West Coast in those days. Eggs were $1 apiece, for example, in the goldfield country. And I could eat because the government provided rations. I couldn't have fed my family.
Okay. Now, you mentioned, at this point, she was still pregnant, correct, with your third child?
Yes, I left in mid-June. Our second son, Ulysses Jr., Buck, because he was born in Ohio, the Buckeye State, was born July 22nd. So I didn't see him for 2 years.
So you had 3 sons?
3 sons and a daughter.
You had a daughter as well. Okay.
Yeah.
What was her name?
Ellen, Nellie. She was named after my wife's mother.
Okay. Let's go on from there. You told us some of the experiences and the moving around that you did after the Mexican War. This is leading up to the time of what we now call, I believe, the Civil War.
And you called it that then, too.
Yeah, I know it was. You were quite instrumental in what happened there. Did you have to be called back into the service, or were you in the service at that time?
No, I had resigned from the Army in 1854 after 2 years out west, because I wanted to get home and see my family again.
Mm-hmm.
In the spring of 1861, when Fort Sumter was attacked, I was working as a clerk in my father and brother's leather and harness wholesale business in Galena, Illinois. I wrote the War Department, reminded them that I had been professionally trained, had spent 15 years in the Army and was a captain, and offering my services in any role that they wanted me. They never wrote back. 15 years later, when I was finishing my last year as president, we moved the War Department offices to a new building, and my letter offering my services was discovered. It had fallen behind a desk in 1861, and nobody ever missed it.
Oh, my. So tell us about you going back into the military and how that came about.
Well, I tried the War Department, didn't have any luck there. I also went to Cincinnati, where a young fellow named George McClellan, a couple of years behind me at West Point, was Major General commanding Ohio troops. I thought maybe I would have a shot at getting on his staff or getting some kind of a command. Didn't work. I spent 2 days in his waiting room, and he never deigned to speak to me. So I went back to Illinois. I had spent a little time there before going to Ohio, helping the Illinois Adjutant General do the forms and paperwork to start organizing regiments of volunteer infantry from the state. I got back. Nothing was on offer, was getting ready to return home to Galena, and the governor stopped me and said, Grant, I understand you spent some time in the Army. Well, I acknowledged that I had. He said, I've got a regiment I'd like to put you in command of. As it happened, it was a regiment I had mustered into state service a few weeks before. It turns out he wanted to give me a regiment, the 21st Illinois, that had gotten a name for itself while it was in camp as Governor Yates' Hellions. It was a group of about 1,000 young men with no discipline whatever. They got their nickname because no hen roost, garden, watermelon patch, or pig pen within 5 miles of their post was safe. They were always out foraging, even though the state was providing them with rations. It took a couple of weeks, but once I took command of the 21st, they turned into good soldiers. They were a new experience. Volunteers were a new experience for me. In the old Army, the enlisted men were in the Army because they couldn't make a living any other way. They would follow orders, but they showed very little initiative, very little skill. With volunteers, for the first time in my life, I was confronted by men who wanted to be soldiers, wanted to learn how to do things, wanted to do them right. That was a new experience for them, and I confess, for me as well.
And what year was this?
This was 1861.
Okay.
I got my commission from Governor Yates about June 15th that year. And by the 1st of August, the 21st and I were off to Missouri. So.
Okay. About the Civil War itself, there are some ideas that the Civil War was not so much about slavery as it was about the states wanting to secede. What's your thoughts on the purpose or
that
the
idea
cause?
Is absolutely wrong.
Okay.
Secession came because the South didn't think it was going to be able to control the federal government as it had under Presidents Pierce and Buchanan in the 1850s. Mm-hmm. Mr. Lincoln, when he became president, made it very clear that, as far as he was concerned, slavery was constitutional and lawful, and he had no business interfering with it where it existed. His position was very clear, though, that slavery would not be extended to any other territory of the United States as long as he was president. That was the pretext that the radicals in the South used to secede from the Union. States' rights was a pretext. Slavery is what the war was about.
Okay. And at one time you had owned slaves.
A slave.
A slave, that's right. That's right. That you had somewhat inherited, actually.
Well, I got him as compensation for work performed. And when I could see that the farm was failing, I sold the livestock and grain and what implements I had, and William Jones and I, my mulatto slave, went to the courthouse in St. Louis, and I did the paperwork to liberate him. I was not averse to the idea of having someone to help me around the farm. An extra set of hands is always welcome, but while I really wasn't anti-slavery, I was not comfortable with the idea of selling a human being. So even though I could have used the money, I emancipated my slave and sent him over to Illinois across the river to a free state. I've never heard from him since. I hope he did well.
Okay. Then when you entered into the Civil War, would you like to tell us about some of the battles that you were in which you were involved?
Well, that could take all the rest of the evening and into tomorrow.
Well, tell us some of the highlights. How's that?
Well, the first big fight my command was in was at a place called Fort Donelson in Tennessee. This was February of 1862. We had moved up on Fort Donelson in what was very warm, pleasant weather. That meant most of the troops under my command had thrown away their blankets and overcoats.
Mm-hmm.
Then a sleet storm hit.
Mm.
So the night before we attacked Fort Donelson, some of the outfits were performing unusual drills like marching in a circle at double time just to keep from freezing to death.
Mm-hmm.
The morning that I had intended to attack, the Confederates beat me to it. They broke out of their position and tried, or I thought, were going to try to escape, but their command structure was very muddled, and they withdrew back into the fort. I wasn't there when the fight began. I was on board the Navy's gunboats talking with Flag Officer Andrew Foote, the guy in command of them. And I didn't know there was a fight heating up till I got ashore. That, interestingly enough, people tend to associate me with cigars, and it was because of Fort Donelson. Just before I left Flag Officer Foote's cabin, he offered me a cigar. Well, I thanked him, put it in my mouth, went outside and lit it, but it was sleeting. So it didn't stay lit. I made one cigar last all day because I couldn't keep it lit.
Okay.
We did win the battle. That's where I issued the message to the Confederate commander that I would only accept an unconditional surrender. Since he had little choice, he agreed. But the newspaper correspondents who were with us were trying to think of something, some distinctive characteristic to give me to their readers. So they fastened on the fact that I had ridden around the battlefield the whole day impassively smoking a cigar. Well, I had ridden around the battlefield the whole day with a cigar in my mouth, but I didn't smoke it because I couldn't keep it lit.
Oh, yes.
The consequence of it was the people up north got the idea that I liked cigars, and within a week, people were shipping me cigars by the box, hundreds at a time, and by the end of the war, just to use up the inventory, you might say, I was smoking up to 20 cigars a day.
Oh, my.
But that's how it came from the reporters. You know, I didn't wear a fancy uniform. I didn't have plumes on my hat. The only thing they had to fix on was, well, he smokes cigars and he doesn't seem to be too afraid. So
now I think of most pictures I've seen of you, you did have a cigar in your hand or in your mouth.
Well, that's because of Fort Donelson. Before that, when I smoked, I had mostly smoked a pipe. But in any event.
You're listening to the Mike Wilson Show on WWGH. My guest today is U.S. Grant. At this point, he is a former president. We're kind of going through some of his life experiences right now. We're into the Civil War. Are there any other experiences you'd like to share Civil War related?
Well, I guess for me, the most memorable day of the war was Sunday, April 9th, 1865. That's when I met General Lee at Appomattox Courthouse. I had met the general once during the Mexican War when he was chief of staff to the commanding general of the Army, General Scott, and I was a second lieutenant managing a pack train of Mexican mules. Needless to say, he made more of an impression on me than I made on him. When we got together at Appomattox, he was in what appeared to me to be practically a brand new uniform, beautifully polished boots, red silk embroidery on them, a gold embroidered sword belt, a very expensive and elaborate sword, and I was in an enlisted man's coat. I was covered with mud and dust from chasing his army down. No sword, no sword belt. The only thing that would indicate that I was even an officer were the shoulder straps on my coat. I remember feeling embarrassed and telling General Lee that I had not dressed that way in order to humiliate him. I just didn't have any other clothes available. It was hard for me to tell how he took the surrender because his face was very impassive. I couldn't read him, but he accepted the surrender terms, which were frankly, well, they were the kind of terms that President Lincoln had told me a couple of weeks ago, previous, that he wanted, that he wanted to let them up easy, as he put it. So the terms of surrender was that the Confederates were to lay down their arms, sign a parole, a document stating that they would not take up arms unless or until they were properly exchanged, and that they go home. I also put in the surrender document that if they did those things and went home, they would have no further trouble from the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
A sidelight on it is that something I didn't realize was that Confederate soldiers, if they rode a horse or were part of an artillery battery, owned their horse. It was not government issue. When General Lee made me aware of that, told me about it, I said, well, it isn't in the formal terms, but if any of your men claims a horse or a mule when he turns in his weapons, my officers will be directed to let him have it. Those fellows will need to get home and get a crop in this spring, and having a horse or a mule will make a world of difference. So that was 5 days before Mr. Lincoln was shot at the theater in Washington. Andrew Johnson, who had been vice president and who became president on Mr. Lincoln's death, called me in a couple of weeks after he took office and said, when can I put General Lee on trial for treason? And I said, well, sir, you can't. He said, what do you mean? I'm the president. I can. I said, no, you can't. The terms of surrender were that as long as they obeyed the laws and laid down their weapons, no further harm would come to them from the federal government. And he said, well, what if I override you? And I said, sir, I'll resign and go to the country and tell them exactly what you're doing. That was the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
We let them up easy.
You spoke of Mr. Lincoln. How was your relationship with Mr. Lincoln during the war? Were you close? Did you always agree? How did that work?
We never really met till the spring of 1864, when he summoned me to Washington to promote me to lieutenant general and make me the commanding general of the entire army. Before that, we had communicated by telegraph, but while it is a rapid way to communicate, you don't develop much of a sense of the person that you're talking to. We got on very well. When I came to Washington, he said, now, Grant, I know you have a plan for what you want to do. I don't want you to tell me what it is, because I don't want to leak it. You know, people ask me questions, and I answer them. So the less I know, the better off we'll both be.
So he trusted you?
He trusted me.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
I understand that a couple of years before, after Fort Donelson and the Battle at Shiloh, and that year, somebody said, well, we understand that this Grant's a heavy drinker. You got to get rid of him. We only want, you know, high-toned people. And I'm told that Mr. Lincoln's response was, I can't spare this man. He fights. So he and I, once we met, got along famously. We were both fellows from the Midwest. We spoke a common language. We came to understand each other pretty well. The last 2 weeks before the final pursuit and surrender of Lee's army, the president had spent the time at our camp where we were besieging the last Confederate positions at Richmond and Petersburg, and he and I had quite a few opportunities to talk to each other. He was incontestably the greatest man I've ever known. He had a talent for putting things in a clear and plain way that anybody could understand. Okay? And no one was more stunned than I. The whole nation was stunned at his death, but He and I got along wonderfully.
Okay. Well, let's move on to your presidency. The year was 1868.
I was elected in November of 1868.
Okay.
Horatio Seymour from New York was my opponent. We beat him by some in the popular vote and overwhelmingly in the electoral vote. So I became president. I will say that the second happiest day of my life was the day I left the White House on March 4th, 1877. The happiest day was the day I married Mrs. Grant. But the thing I am proudest of about my time in the White House was that I enforced the law. The law in particular that I'm speaking about is the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The 13th Amendment that was being ratified at the time of Mr. Lincoln's death abolished slavery. 2 years later, the 14th Amendment said that anyone born in the United States was a citizen of the United States and of the state where they lived. A lot of people had said, well, the slaves are freed, but they're not really citizens. Well, the 14th Amendment put that matter to bed. The 15th Amendment said that all citizens of the United States are entitled to vote, regardless of race, color, or previous condition of servitude.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Many people in the South had not fully adjusted to the fact that the war was over, that slavery was over, and that their former slaves were now their fellow citizens. One of the things that was done to try to reinforce the old way of doing things was the formation of a group called the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh, yes.
With the help of my attorney general, the U.S. attorneys in the southern states, and the United States Army, I am pleased to report that we completely broke the back of the Klan. Wiped them off the face of the earth. Now, that viewpoint that the freed slaves ought not to be full citizens didn't go away, but the Klan's organization did. The greatest regret of my presidency is that after I left office, as a result of the 1876 election, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, there was a hotly contested election. And the Republicans said, look, if you let our candidate, Rutherford B. Hayes, become president, we'll withdraw the U.S. Army from the South. Well, that was the end of enforcing the right for the black people of the South to vote. Many of those colored persons had, well, by the time the Civil War ended, I had 1 million men under my command. 1 out of 6 of those soldiers was a colored soldier.
Mm-hmm.
160,000 men. Many of them went back to live in the South where they had come from. And not only did the Constitution require that they be treated as full voting citizens, one of the first things that a young officer learns is to look out for his troops, to see that they're cared for. Well, many of those colored men in the South had been my troops. And the instinct to look out for your men is not something you lose with the passage of time. If the Constitution and the Congress and the states had given them the right to vote, I felt it was my duty to see that that right was enforced. So though the high point of my presidency was enforcing the law, the low point was seeing that process come to an end as soon as I left the White House.
Certainly. Back to you running for president. Did you have to be persuaded, or were you all on board with running, throwing your hat in the ring?
My friends thought it would be a good thing for me to run for president to protect the gains that the nation had won in the Civil War. I was not enthusiastic. In neither election in 1868 or 1872 did I actively campaign. As I say, the second happiest day of my life was the day I left the White House. In the Army, where I had spent 23 years, if someone outranked me and told me to do something, that was an order, and right. I did it. Mm-hmm. In Washington, if the president tells Congress to do something, they're apt to respond rudely and go their own way.
Right.
So it was easier to, horrible as the war was, it was easier to fight a war than it was to try to work with Congress. I imagine every president, back to Mr. Washington, would sympathize with that feeling.
Well, in our current time, we still have that same situation. That hasn't changed, Mr. President.
Well, human nature hasn't changed, evidently.
No, sir, it hasn't. I I'll pass this along. I had read someplace, I think on Google, which you have no idea what that is, but it's a modern day newspaper. Let's put it that way.
All right.
I had seen that Congress is actually what they call a group of baboons. Is a Congress. So I would think that would be apropos in this case.
That's interesting. I understand that in England they call a group of crows a murder of crows. Now, in Ohio, where I grew up, a group of crows was referred to a Congress because they made a lot of noise and nothing much got accomplished.
So true, so true. Okay, we have about 3 minutes. What was your life like after you left the White House, which seems to have been a real high point in your life?
Leaving it was a great thing. I spent, Mrs. Grant and our youngest son, Jesse, and I spent the next 2.5 years on a tour around the world.
Oh.
We visited for a couple of months in England, where my daughter Nellie was living. She had married an Englishman named Algernon Sartress, a young man of fine appearance, but miserable qualities otherwise. I won't go into that. We visited France. We visited Germany. I was invited to speak with Mr. Bismarck, or Prince Bismarck, the Chancellor of the German Empire. I surprised him. My hotel was 2 or 3 blocks from his palace, so rather than hiring a cab or a carriage, I just lit a cigar and walked down and visited with him.
Mm-hmm.
He was an interesting man. We went across the Mediterranean in Istanbul, Constantinople, I'm sorry. I visited the Turkish Sultan, a man who also was very fond of horses, had a stable with 400 in them. He said, "Grant, go out and look them over. Any 2 horses that you want, you can have as a gift." Well, I spent half a day in his stables and picked 2 out and went back. And he said, "Which 2 did you select?" And I told him. And he said, "Well, any 2 but them."
Oh, really?
So I didn't get the horses I wanted, but I got 2 fine Arabians, which were shipped back to the United States and have done a good bit to upgrade the breeding pool for that variety of horse here. But we visited China, Japan, and then came across the United States from west to east.
Okay. And after you came back home, where did you end up? In Ohio, or where did you
No,
end up?
I haven't lived in Ohio since You're I left
listening
for
to
West
WWPH
Point when I was 17.
Radio 107.1
We're
LP
currently
Marion, Ohio.
In downtown
the place
New York
to
City,
talk
my son Buck,
legendary comedian
and
Abe Vigoda.
A young fellow named Frank.
You know,
Dan
Abe,
Ward,
there's been this thing for years that people thought you were Ward. Dead. Do you think that has worked
that
against you in your career?
In the business, so.
Well,
Mr. Grant, thank you for spending some time with us today.
It
was very enlightening. Thank you, sir.
You're very welcome.